Blog Talk Radio.
It's showtime.
Greetings and welcome to CAG Do About Your Dog and You, sponsored by Captor Area Guide Dog Users, Inc. CAG Do Show is, we answer the question of why you should get a dog, where should you get a guide dog, when should you get a guide dog, what is a guide dog, and how you get a guide dog. And our very special guest will be sharing the answer to some of those questions for her. Welcome, our listening audience. This is CAG Do About Your Dog and You. I am your host, Reverend Radio Ray Razor. We still have the black cover over our microphone for our co-host, Mr. Charlie Crawford, who passed the last year. And we know we celebrated a year of CAG Do's being on the air last month. So we still haven't yet chosen a co-host. They can't feel Mr. Charlie's shoes, but we're going to come close to it as we can. So we will let you know further in the year who we chosen for a guest, permanent guest host. So welcome, my listening audience, again, and I will say, how are you doing today, Miss Renee?
I'm great, Reverend, and you?
Oh, I don't know, Miss Renee. I'm so confused. I go outside. I have my mask on. I don't know to take it off. I don't know to put it on. I don't know to take it off. they just keep confusing me. They saying now, yeah. And we are fully. I have my shots. And I have my card I carry with me, and they're saying if you CDC said that if you have your full shots, then you can go madless without a mask.
Yeah.
Well, inside and out. And I noticed that the president of Mr. Biden, him and his whole staff, when they were doing a press conference yesterday, they all was unmasked. So I don't know. Now,
well, you know, it's really confusing because the New York Yankees just had 8 fully vaccinated players come up positive. So you're right. It's very confusing.
Well, as time goes on, we will see. So until then, we will do what we have to do, Miss Renee, and give us a rundown for our show today.
Well, our show lineup is Stop Dogging Us Around, the Good, Bad, and the Ugly of Using a Guide Dog, sorry. and our guests, membership organizations depend on state leaders to translate the vision into reality. And our guest, Joanne Cusick, is the president of the ACB, that's the American Council of the Blind, Maryland State Affiliate. I know it's a mouthful, but it means she's in the know. And then in our second half, even though Charlie has no longer in his seat, we still peer into Charlie's corner. So back over to you, Reverend Ray, for Stop Dogging Us Around.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Renee. And I'm going to take since I'm not writing and it's not literary privileges, I'm going to take broadcast privileges and to stop dogging around, usually talking about using the guide dog, the good, the bad, and the ugly. But I just want to give our sympathies, especially as guide dog owners, to the Bidens, President Biden. They lost one of their dogs. They have two.
No, wrong president, Fodge. Sir. Wrong president.
Biden? President Biden? Who did I say?
No, you
okay,
said Biden,
President
but it
Biden.
It could be the former president.
Yes, the former president, President Obama.
Barack Obama.
President Obama. Yeah, he lost his dog, Bo. And Bo was 13 years old, and it was a dog that was given to him, I think one of his children had an allergy, and this dog hair didn't share what it affect his daughter. And it was given to him by one of the Kennedys, I believe. And so you can always, you know, facts all that stuff now. But anyway, so we just want to say, President Obama, former President Obama, we do understand that guide dogs owners, the loss of, especially having a dog that long in your family, it is like family. So anyway, we're going to say that for stop dogging us around. So Ms. Renee, now let's get quickly to our special guest.
I would be honored. Our guest is Joanne Cusick. She is the president of the ACB, that's the American Council of the Blind, the Maryland State affiliate. Welcome, Ms. Cusick.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me, and thanks for having me.
Well, thank you very much, Joanne. It's always special for me because I am alumni of Maryland School for the Blind, that they hear me talk about all the time. And Joanne is a alumni. She went to Maryland School for the Blind, I think, all your life pretty much. Isn't that right,
yeah,
Joanne?
Yeah, I did. Pretty much, yeah. I started in kindergarten and went through till the 12th grade. I also attended Parkville Senior High for 2 years, took three courses there, history and English and an elective each year. So I actually graduated from Parkville Senior High and MSB. So that was kind of unique.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my. Okay. Yeah. Other than you being and your mother being in the maternity ward at Maryland School for the Blind in the nursery, you were, you spent your whole life there for the most part. Well, thank you, Joanne, for joining us. And we always like to get to know the person because I say now with the computer and internet, any occupation that a person now does, you could just go online, tap. And for blind people, just talk to it, and it will tell you all about it. So people like to know, as we like to know, about the human element of it. So you just told us a little bit about yourself. So just give us a little more about your background, where you came from. Did you come from the stalk that, you know, that left you, or what you found on the steps, like Mighty Mouse, or, you know. So give us a little bit about your background, please.
Okay. I was born here in Baltimore. I spent my first few months at Union Memorial Hospital. I was one of those babies that was born prematurely. Was put in the incubator because they thought I needed more oxygen. Of course, that scarred the retina, and here I am. I weighed 2.5 pounds when I was born. I went down to 1 pound, 12 or 14 ounces, something like that before I gained the weight, and I could have gone home, I think, after 2 months, but I spent an additional month in the hospital because they were trying to save, you know, whatever sight they could, which wasn't much. I had a little bit of light perception in my left eye. You know, like I could tell when it was cloudy or sunny and whether, you know, a light was on, but I don't even know if I can do that anymore because I just, you know, don't use it, you know, like I used to. I went to MSB, of course, I told you that, and I went, right. I have 4 years of college, bachelor's, BA degree in sociology, got it from Loyola, well, it was Loyola College of Baltimore, now it's Loyola University, Maryland. I started out at Mount St. Agnes College, it was a 4-year school, but they merged with Loyola, so I ended up graduating from Loyola. I worked for 38 years it was part of Social Security. It was the Office of Hearings and Appeals, which became the Office of Disability Adjudication and Review. Actually, I first started, we worked for 5.5 years giving out job information for the Office of Personnel Management about federal jobs. And then I moved on to OHA and typed decisions on a Wang machine, believe it or not. And
wow.
I'm dating myself here, but I did that, and then I got promoted to hearing clerk or whatever, and then senior case technician. Finally, when I retired, I had a reader, and we put cases together. I decided what should be an exhibit and what shouldn't, and how they should go in order, and all that kind of thing. And so we did that, and I also did a lot of scheduling of hearings before administrative law judges, which got more complicated. The more people you had, well, if you had just had a claimant, that was one thing, but then you got, you know, they had a representative, and you had a vocational expert, and maybe a medical expert too, and then sometimes people had translators because they couldn't speak English, so it was interesting, but I left after 38 years of government service.
Wow.
In November of 2013, and I've been living here at Oakcrest. I'm in Parkville since April of 2014, so here I am.
Wow. Okay, let me ask you a couple of questions.
May I go back?
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I wanted to go back to when you said that you were born basically with, you lost your sight as an infant, so you never saw. When did you realize that the rest of the world didn't see the world the way you saw it?
I don't really know. I know that, Mrs. Minturn used to come and visit us when I was a kid, and, a little girl, like, even before I started school, she would come and visit us to see how I was doing and developing and blah, blah, blah. And I know that, I guess my parents knew it when I was about 8 or 9 months old or something. They told them that, you know, I was going to be totally blind, blind, blah, blah, blah. And my parents went to an ophthalmologist. He told them, and his secretary right away called MSB to enroll us. And I know my mother went to some kind of a seminar or whatever at MSB, because I guess they were having, these seminar or whatever things for, parents. You know, a lot of kids were being born blind or, going blind or, whatever. And I don't remember seeing it all, put it that, so I have no memory of that at all.
It was standard operating procedure at that time to
Yes, it was,
infants,
yeah. Uh-huh.
They didn't know why
we were all of us were losing our sight. They didn't put it together till a couple of years after I was born.
Exactly. Did you have siblings?
I have a brother. I had a brother. He was like 8 years older, and he was fine, but he passed away in April of 2013. So.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. But it's just wondering what the dynamic in a family would be with the child that, when did you discover that? The rest of the world doesn't see the world like I do. So interesting that your parents were so proactive.
Well, they were, and I went to Maryland School for the Blind, and I went in and I wanted to, in kindergarten, we had Mrs. Mitchell, who is no longer with us, but, there were a bunch of kids in my class, and I wanted to run, and it was like, you can't run because we're right near the steps, and I guess when I was in, like, kindergarten, I guess I really understood that, things were different. I really don't remember. I mean, I know we learned to read Braille in kindergarten. Some of the... we started to learn the alphabet and that kind of thing, and words, with like ball and things like that, B-A-L-L, and, started to learn the configuration. And I guess we didn't learn really to write Braille until second grade or something like that. Yeah, I think. And then we learned to use a slate and stylus, I think, in the fourth grade, at least I did.
For people who don't understand, for people who are not familiar with that, What is a Slayton stylist, and what does it allow a student to do, or a person
well,
blind to do?
It's very low tech, but it's, you know, with all the smartphone technology and everything that they have, it's really it's you with this the slate has it has blocked light
right
there.
We're gonna give you a chance to describe.
Yeah,
it
when you hear that music, Reverend Ray has to take a break and pay some bills. So you had time to coin your answer on the other side of the break in 30 seconds. So this is CAGDU about your dog and you, and I am Reverend Radio Razor, your host, and our announcer will take us on the other side of the break and then bring us back with our very special guest.
You are listening to CAGDU about your dog and you. CAGDU stands for Capital Area Dog Guide Users. We are located in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., and that includes Maryland and Virginia. But the information we share is for dog guide users everywhere. Back over to our host, Reverend Radio Ray Razor.
All righty. Our special guest is Joanne Cusack. And Joanne, we were giving you the difficult to task to explain the Slayton stylist. And for those who are excited, I'll help you out here. A slate is like what most people will, as sighted people will see, like a ruler. So just take like a ruler and you put it across a piece of paper, but it has a little holes in it where you can punch in paper and it comes up with dots, and they have like six dots in a cell one across, and the stylus is what most people now use to write on their tablets. A lot of people use a stylus now to write on their tablets, so that's where the Slayton stylus is.
Yes,
but Joanne, let me ask you this though. Family, how did your parents take you being blind? Parents are parents.
How did they deal with that? My mom was kind of like overprotective to some degree. She eventually, when I started at MSB, I was a day student and I went home every day, but eventually, like in the third grade, they decided that I should stay, that they thought that I could learn, you know, there were things that I could learn there better than my mother could teach me, like how to use, the stove and stuff like that. So I eventually stayed and went home every weekend. So, they celebrated, birthdays and all this kind of stuff, and my mother made sure that I was, my clothes were, that I had decent clothes and everything, that I was dressed, okay. I mean, it didn't look, funny because, because I was blind.
Right.
I mean, she was very good. She was very good at, putting colors together and stuff like that. And we'd go shopping and she would explain, well, this is such and such a color. And I'm, what color is that?
Like you have something to relate it to, like, oh yeah, that's yellow,
like,
so that's a little lighter than black.
like fuchsia, what is fuchsia or what is mauve? I'm like, what is that? But she made sure that I I was dressed, well.
Let me ask you this. Me going to a resident, also going there, and we know it's a residential school, and I was fortunate enough to come home every weekend as well. So as you was growing up, what type of social, because being there, MSB, 90% of your time is there. So what type of social life did you have at home and when you had those summers? Where you was home for a couple of months.
Did
you have some? Okay.
Well, I mean, there were some kids in the neighborhood that I, you know, socialized with, and we you know, went to church every Sunday, and I was integrated into that. But beyond that, I guess I know I read a lot of like talking books and braille books and stuff like that. I love to read. I still do. I still read mostly by talking books, just because I don't have the space for braille stuff. You know, a lot of braille stuff here.
Mm.
But I got along with my brother and his friend, you know, friends and stuff like that, even though I was the little sister, you know.
right.
But like, you know, we had family, and we visited, you know, aunts and uncles and, you know, cousins and stuff like that, you know, during the summer and stuff, things like that. So, you know,
Let me ask you, was summer dreaded, or did you look forward, like, you know, most public school kids, they like can't wait till school's over to go home for the summer.
I think I kind of looked forward to it. I certainly didn't dread it. I liked, you know, I enjoyed it. I mean, we had friends who had, you know, pools and, you know, in the backyard, or, you know, they lived, had shore property, you know, so I was used to the water. I had my dad's family lived in Western Pennsylvania, so we used to go on vacation up there. So I got to see my aunts and uncles on dad's side of the family, you know, during the summer, my cousins and stuff like that. So, you know, it was, you know,
a normal childhood, as normal as you could get.
Yeah, put it that way.
You raised a question I had never thought about before. Did you know how to swim, or did you learn how to swim?
No, I've never learned how to swim. I played in the water. I mean, you know, and stuff like that. You know, kind of like, I want to say, I tried to stay in the shallow end when I went in the water, you know.
I hadn't thought about it until you talked about being in the water. And, you know, there are so many proscriptions that sighted people think about what blind people can and can't do. And I just never thought about it. And I thought when Reverend Ray asked you about what was your parents' attitude and that kind of thing, it sounds like they made sure you were safe, but they also wanted you to experience the world in its totality.
Oh, yeah, they did,
So what prompted you to get a guide dog?
Well, I was in Mount St. Agnes College was a very small liberal arts college for women. It had, like, maybe three buildings, and I'd used a cane okay. And then I was going to Loyola, and I mean, they were merging with Loyola, so I was going, you know, over there. And it really scared me. I use a cane fine, and I guess you'd call me a route traveler, you know, you know, if you know what that, right? I mean, it's like you learn a route, you know it, you know, and that kind of stuff. I mean, Loyola, there were a lot more buildings, and it was, you know, all over the place and stuff. So my brother said one day, why don't you get a dog? And I'm thinking, a dog? Well, I mean, we'd had dogs when I was a child, so I liked dogs, And so I thought, well, why not apply, you know? So somebody told me about Guide Dogs for the Blind in California, and I applied, and I was accepted, and I had seven dogs from there, and I just in November of 2019, I got my first guide dog from Freedom Guide Dogs in Cassville, New York, which is upstate New York. And the game changer is they bring the dog to you. You don't have to go to a class, you know, for two to four weeks, whatever, depending upon the situation. They bring the dog to you and train you for what you need, and they stay like roughly 2 weeks, and So I have a male yellow lab named Larry, who will be four years old August 15th. And he's laying here at my feet. And so it's, really...
Joanne, let me ask, so up to that point, did you know any blind individual with dogs?
Well, when I got my dog, I only knew this lady named Helen Tullis, and some people may have heard of her. She is, of course, no longer living, but she'd had dogs from different schools. And the story, you know, the thing that I'd heard was that one of her dogs actually got killed saving her from being hit by a car. So my parents had known her at some point, but I contacted her before, you know, when I was trying to decide where to apply. And she's the one who convinced me to apply to GDB because they had a good breeding program, they had a good follow-up, and, you know, that kind of thing. So I did, and they accepted me. And I've had all Labrador Retrievers, three black and four yellow, I guess it was. I guess it has been.
Wow.
And
okay, all labs.
Yes, all labs. Because I liked labs. I mean, they gave me my first lab, and I really liked her, and I just said, you know, it was either labs, goldens, or German shepherds, and I knew I didn't want a German shepherd for some reason. I just couldn't picture myself with one. And they gave me all labs, and so I only had one male. The rest were all females, and people, you know, they always ask you which one is your favorite. Well, it's the one you have now because that's the one you're working with, and that's the one you know the best, you know. Have memories, you know, special places for the rest of them in your heart, you know, whatever, but this is what you have now, and this is, you know, what we're working, and you know, this is what you're used to now, and this is what's alive, and that kind of thing, you know. So
let me jump in here. I want to ask a question. You said the first school was, what was the name of the school?
Guide Dogs for the Blind in San Rafael, California.
Okay, so Guide Dogs for the Blind, and then you changed schools. And the second school, which was one?
Well, the one I got Larry from is called Freedom Guide Dogs Incorporated. It's in Cassville, New York. Cassville. It's upstate New York.
Okay, so different schools are the philosophies, and I know you said that Freedom Guide came to you. Was there a big transition from you from the training that you got at Guide Dogs versus Freedom Guide?
Not really. I mean, by then, I mean, I'd had seven dogs, so I knew what was what was going on. I knew commands. I knew, you know, what I could and couldn't do, what I should and shouldn't do, you know. You know, you don't let them up on the furniture or the bed, or at least I don't, you know. My dogs stay on the floor. I knew how to hold a harness, and I knew how to, you know, use a leash, and I knew how to relieve them, and, you know, what the schedule would be like, you know, for relieving and feeding and et cetera, et cetera. So I think I went 6 years without a dog, I should say that.
Oh, wow. Really?
My last dog from GDB was in 2013, and I didn't get Larry until 2019 because I applied a couple other schools, and they said, well, you're not doing enough work, blah, blah, blah. You know, we don't think you need a dog. And the guy at Freedom just said, are you going to use it? And where are you from? Because they only do training on the Eastern Seaboard along the East Coast because they're a small school. And when I applied, I didn't even really ask how long it would be. I just figured, you know, they'd come up, you know, they'd, you know, contact them, and they had a dog. And so I was surprised that he called me. I applied in January of 2019. He came in April to interview me, to see me. I got a letter in June that I'd been accepted, although he told me that I was. And then in September of 2019, they contacted me and said, you know, we have a dog for you. And I'm thinking, gee, that's fast. And then I had told them that I was going to Denver for one of my niece's wedding. And he said, well, we'll wait till you come back to train you.
Wow. Okay, that's our break, our half of our break, and we're going to be back with our special guest, Joanne Cusick. And this is CAGDU, About Your Dog and You. I am your host, Reverend Radio Ray Razor, and our host with the mostest, Engineer, will take us to break.
We want to thank our sponsor, Big Bad Wolf, a primo pet store located in Northwest Washington, D.C. They carry raw, organic, and premium foods. If your dog needs it, they more than likely have it. They have store-to-door deliveries in the DMV. Give them a call at 202-747-3434. That's 202-747-3434. Back over to Reverend Ray.
All righty. At this time, we usually peer into Charlie's place with Charlie C. That had passed. So it used to be Charlie C. that had information for the DMV, and it was sponsored by the Silver Springs affiliate chapter, which Mr. Pat Sheehan is the president. We had him on as a guest host from time to time, and they're sponsored by their chapter, which is the National Capital Area Chapter. Charlie C., we're going to put him on hold to next week because our special guest has wear many hats, and she one of those hats going to take her away from us in 15 minutes. So we want to get right into her volunteer work with American Council of the Blind, which is, believe me, if you in any of these blind organizations and you at the top of the food chain, it is like a job. So it is like a job. You would think these people get paid, getting overtime, in some cases getting hazard pay. So, Joanne, we know the American Council of the Blind organization has been around for years, and in 2 months their national convention is coming up, and it's going to be the second year virtual. And the first year, they did a fabulous job. Herb Bridges, we didn't have him on the show as a guest, as well as Tony Stevens. He has a dog. We had him on our show as a guest. So we had a number of those folks on our show as a guest. But, Joanne, tell us how you got involved with the American Council of the Blind and some of the activities or more than resolutions in this time of COVID, you all are doing.
Okay, let's see. Gosh, I've been involved. I got involved with ACB, I guess, in the early 90s. I think the first convention I went to was to Tampa in the summertime, humidity and, you know, rain. But I think I had some of interaction with the other organization when I was younger, much younger. And then after a while, I didn't do it. And then other people, you know, I knew were joining ACB, so I joined the Central Maryland Council of the Blind, which is our affiliate, local affiliate here in Baltimore, in the Baltimore area. And they, Cindy Laban was president, and she couldn't run anymore, and I was vice president, so when she filled out her term, her three terms, I got promoted, and they elected me by acclamation, and here I am. And then I assumed it in January of 2020, and right after that, COVID came. And so we subscribed to something called One Call Now, which we all thought was a service that allows you to leave messages for your organization And then they send the messages to the members of your, you know, organization, whatever phone number they give them. You know, so we thought that was really, it kind of kept us all connected. We could send out messages like anything that was coming up that we needed answers to or just wanted to spread the word. So that was really good. Thank God for Zoom because we've been doing our board meetings monthly. We have monthly board of directors meetings, officers and board of directors, and we've been meeting by Zoom. Thank goodness for that. I'm sure they're making a killing off of all of us people using it, but, you know, thank God we could use Zoom because we sure couldn't get together. You know, we couldn't have a convention. In fact, we even put off having a, you know, a state convention because we didn't know what was going to happen with COVID. As it turned out, we had one in January, the last weekend in January, and I have to say hats off to my vice president, Meryl Schechter, and her committee.
Yes.
Pat Chan, James Corona, Robin Hughes, Glenda Blanchard. They really did a dynamite job of putting together the convention.
They did.
Excellent. Friday night we had a showcase of different vendors like Guidelights and Gadgets and the AT guys, technology, and then we did Pampered Chef and the Maryland Technology Assistance Program, and just it was just really good. And then Saturday we had everything from the Maryland State Library for the Blind and Print Disabled to in the afternoon they did a presentation from the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. So, I mean, it was
let's not forget the auction that I bought something from.
That auction was great. We raised almost $1,900 in that auction.
Yes.
Wow.
What made that so much better was nobody had to go anywhere to do it. People could you know, bid right from the comfort of their own homes. And, you know, that people could register for the convention from all over the country. So it was really a win-win situation. And then Sunday morning we had our business meeting, which was not recorded, but I guess you probably could still find the convention somewhere in the podcast if you wanted to.
Let me stop you there because time is short. And a lot of people ask this, and so I'll ask you as well, being the president of the state. A lot of people, was able to, from the comfort of their home, and people that have, there have been people never been to a convention or could afford to go to a convention, and they was able to participate. So in the future coming up, are you all given any thought to having a combination convention with a Zoom aspect of it, or is it going to just go strictly back to in person? Or have you even had that discussion?
We sort of have, but I think it'll probably be a hybrid. Part of it will be virtual, and if people can come, and you know, we'll get together, and you know, that would be the ideal thing, but. I'm sure it will probably end up being a hybrid convention because so many people, couldn't come and can't travel for whatever reason, health reasons, whatever, you know. So I would think it will be a hybrid somewhere along the way. And then I think after that we're going to have a social thing where we're actually going to, you know, get together and just, you know, get to know other people, you know, each other after the convention is over. So I don't know. I think probably maybe we'll do that next year. I don't know. We haven't even, you know, it's still too early to start like planning, and so many things are changing that, you know, they'll have to have that discussion. So
let me ask you this. And I'm, Harry Truman said, that the only friend, if you want to have a friend in Washington, D.C., get you a dog. So saying that, let me ask you this. if you would to have to write down negatives and positives of your working experience, your traveling experience, having a guide dog, and I'm not asking you, the positives for you, do they outweigh the negatives?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think so. People know dogs. I mean, people, you know, dogs are great icebreakers with people because everybody has a pet dog, and I wish my dog could do that. Well, you know, your dog's not trained to do that, but, you know, and your dog's not, well, you know, most people's dogs are not as well-behaved as, you know, guide dogs are, but, you know, there are, you know, hassles with, you know, what if your dog gets sick or, you know, you got to carry around extra food or whatever, but, you know, if you're going somewhere and you can get somebody to get food, you know, when you get out there or wherever you were going, you know, like at ACB conventions, they'll, you know, when they have them, live, they have, you can order dog food and have it at the hotel
right.
when you get there, you know, so that's,
right.
you know, a really neat thing.
Right.
Okay. So
we know you must go, and we'll look forward. There'll be other events coming up, so we will look forward to having you back again, and you won't be a guest. You'll be a family member, and we will treat you like family. That means you got to put behind your own coat. That means you have to hang your own coat up. You have to get your own water out the refrigerator and all of that. So thank you so much, Joan, for sharing some parts of your life and your daily life with you and your dog, Mr. Larry. All right?
Well,
so God bless you.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate you guys inviting me, and I look forward to coming back. And
all right.
Wolf from Larry.
Okay, thank you there. All right, God bless you.
Have a good weekend.
All right, so that was our very very special guest, Joanne Cusack, and like I said, she is a graduate and alumni of Maryland School for the Blind, where I spent from 66 to 71. I lost my sight in 64. And I went to Columbia Lighthouse for the Blind to get some initial training of how to use a cane, some independent living. I didn't do too well in cooking. I just ate more of the other kids' food than I did cook. when it came to sewing, I kept on sticking my finger. When it came to making up a bed, I just couldn't get those corners tucked in right. I told them, why would we use it? Yeah, I asked them, why couldn't we use fitted sheets? So I was just, you know, I just told them, look, I'm just going to make a lot of money, and I'm going to hire people. So do I have to take these classes anymore? And, so I got a note pinned to me and sent home. I got a note pinned to me in print, which I didn't know what it said, and sent home. So anyway, I finally did get through that torture of 2 years of learning how to use a cane and getting some mobility training, some sensitivity training, how to fold money. I told them, how are you going to fold money if you don't have money? And they say, well, you can only use this plate money. So anyway, we went through that. But it was a learning experience. And after getting those so-called blind skills, I was introduced to Maryland School for the Blind, which I lived in D.C. at the time. And of course, as our guest said, she was a day student because she lived in Baltimore. And then she became a student to go on the weekend, only come home on the weekend, which we had, I don't know, probably about 20, 25 kids from Washington area, the Greyhound bus every Sunday, and went to Maryland School for the Blind. And then we came home on a Friday. But we was basically residential students. And it was the independence that it gave you, because we didn't use canes. I think it was about 300 students on this 99-acre campus with a number of buildings and all. And it was laid out where it was pretty simple
to a degree and had some railings and that kind of thing. And so the school was thought out and for, you know, with in mind that blind people would be going to this school and going from building to building, cottage to cottage, that kind of thing. And so in terms of independence, it really taught you as a blind person how to be independent. We had chores in the dorms. Every week you had a chore. You either empty the trash cans in the building, you wash dishes, which I still wash dishes now, and I think my wife thinks that I'm, you know, still want to keep up my skills as washing dishes and drying them, so I'm still doing that now after 50 years. We had to learn to wash. So we learned to do a number of things. We had to set the table up and all that. So we learned a lot of independent skills at Maryland School for the Blind. And there's go ahead.
No, but
and
you
as
know,
I
as
guess,
a person,
go ahead.
Yeah, and as our guest pointed out, it's that social aspect too, because just learning how to do the rudiments of living life. You don't think about that too often, and that's all part of it makes it you, and it's social. And so, you know, she talked about attending church, and she talked about playing with the kids in the neighborhood. But as a residential student, since many of us did not stay at residential schools, we have no concept of what that might have felt like, this community that you have built. And I guess it's why your ties are so strong. You know, I went back to one or two of my class reunions, but I don't go back. And now on Facebook, they always post someone who has passed on. But, you know, we did not have the same camaraderie that you established with your fellow students. And I guess that residential, they were more like extended family than just, you know, casual students that you saw in class. So
well, we had our clicks now. I mean, don't forget that was an era of still Jim Crow sort of grudgingly fading away, because believe it or not, a couple of years before that, it was a segregated school where blind white people was on one side of the rail and blind black people was on their own black rail. So even though the physical change in terms of now all students, black and white, could be in the same dorms, same rooms, and all of that, still the humanist part of it didn't sink into some children and parents that during that time, you know, was not happy about their white children mixing with black students. I mean, and so those white kids were reflecting, even though they was blind, they couldn't tell, you know, if they got their sight back and you told them, oh, yeah, this is what white is, and you know, or this is what black is, they could be a purple person, a red person, yellow person. They wouldn't know, but the philosophy and the training to you know, not like another race, and you can't even see the race, was really, really confusing, you know, confusing. Go ahead.
So the housing was segregated also?
Yes, for a while. The housing,
wow.
Yes, was segregated
okay.
in terms
I mean,
of
you said
the
about
room.
The railings. Yeah, you said about
yeah.
the railings getting from room to room, and I guess the logic would follow that the students, even though they couldn't see, were segregated by race
right.
based on philosophy and internalized racism. Yeah, wow.
Yeah. And the thing
That's
about
amazing.
And you think – and you think about if you black or white, and Joanne didn't have much of a Baltimore accent, but you think about it, you black or white, you live in Baltimore, you still have pretty much the same accent, And this is where kids was confused. They didn't know if they were black or white and had to get in the group with the white. White teachers had to tell them, no, you have to be, you over here with the black people. You over here with the white people, because they didn't know, they couldn't see. So they had no way to say, oh, well, I should be over here. I mean, an actual teacher had, a seeing teacher had to actually tell them, no, you sit over here with the white people. No, you sit over. And if you didn't know people and you were just in the line, or you all came in like on Sunday, when you came back on Sunday and the buses pull up, well, all the kids are there getting their when someone helping them, you know, read their name to get their suitcase to give it to them. So right there, all the black and white kids are standing together and all. They don't know until the teacher say, oh, no, he's black, he should be over here. Oh, no, he's white, he should be over here. I mean, can you imagine psychologically, you know, how confusing, you know, that is? And it's like, did I do something wrong, you know, or whatever. So it was, so socially, I always say this, when it came to Scholastic, when, you know, learning, the school was really great. But when it came to social skills and social growing, you was really stunted. And you heard our guest, Joanne, say that she had the opportunity to go to Parkville. Now, Parkville was for upper-class students that was looking to go to college. They had decided, you know, a couple, and when they got into high school, they're going to go to college. So they had them go to a public school that was right outside the campus for the next 2 or 3 years to socialize themselves and see what it would be like to actually compete their skills or pit their skills against the real world and with sighted students and all, and then they would know not just
scholastically whether they could keep up.
Right. Not only that, but also they had the social skills and the human and the human interaction to be able to go on to the next step to college. But there was a lot of skills that a lot of kids in Rural School for the Blind, they could run rings around sighted kids at Parkville. But when it came to the social and the people skills, they didn't have it. They weren't able to, and that was determined, it was able to be determined then. So it wasn't any need for them, because they weren't going to go to college and just take tests all day long. They had to live, mm-hmm. you know, they're going to live on college and then what side school they could go to. Some people, you know, was able to just go to maybe a small college and go home every day. Or they was able to go to a college where they could live on the college campus. So those things was determined and set out for you. So it wasn't so much that you as a blind person could say, oh, well, I'm going to I like the Wolverines, so I'm going to Michigan. You know, I like the wheel, though. It didn't work like mm-hmm. that. It's because for the most part, the state paid for 90% or 95% of the blind people that went to college from a residential school or a public school is paid for by their state. So they have a lot when it comes to their decision-making. So anyway,
that might have been interesting. Here again, it was more than interesting, because I think sometimes we forget that the decisions that adults make for young people can change the trajectory of their life forever. And whether we base it on social skills, or whether we base it on race, or whether we base it on academic readiness. You know, some people don't, what do they call them, late bloomers. They may not bloom until late. So that could be pretty,
And the interesting thing about it as we close, after 50 years or so, now some of us blind students, graduates, talk about what it was like then, and, you know, and because of that, we didn't work with each other. We didn't get to know each other, whereas now, after all these years, we are working together, some of us students. We, you know, we getting to know each other as an individual, which is really, really interesting. And one thing real quick I want to comment on that you had asked her about swimming for blind people. And one of the things that happened in Columbia Lighthouse for the Blind, they realized that was an issue about blind people swimming. So they came up with a program where it taught blind people how to swim. I mean, they had to come up with a specific program that taught, and I was fortunate enough, even though I could swim before I lost my sight at 13, but it was a whole different ball game being blind and going swimming. So they did teach us that, and every state, every, you know, jurisdiction dealing with blind people didn't have a program like that, but they did, and I appreciate Washington, D.C. for doing that, and Columbia Lighthouse for the Blind. So I take it, Ms. Renee, that's our sound off music. I want to thank you.
As fascinating as this is, we have to say goodbye to our listeners.
Okay, so this is, I want to thank our listening audience for joining us today. This is CAGDU About Your Dog and You. And I am your host, Reverend Radio Ray Razor. And as I always like to say, you can hug your honey, but pet your pooch. God bless and be blessed.
You have been listening to CAGDU About Your Dog and You, Capital Area Dog Guide Users, located in the nation's capital. We are heard here every Friday at 3 o'clock p.m. Eastern Daylight Savings Time. Have a question or a show idea? You can contact us in all the usual ways. Our email is cagdu2020@gmail.com. That's cagdu2020@gmail.com. Or you can call us at 301-263-7371. That's 301-263-7371. Any closing remarks, Reverend?
No, ma'am, other than decide what you're going to do about that mask. But if you see Reverend Ray outside, you're only going to recognize him with his guide dog and his preach collar and shirt on, because other than that, he will have on his mask.
Well, thank you, Reverend. Well, we want to thank our listeners, and we want to remind you to tune in next week at the same time, 3 o'clock p.m. Eastern Daylight Savings Time, and listen to what our guests tell you about CAGDU.